Kickoff with Cathal Minogue and Sky Sports.
Watch every Premier League match this season with Sky Sports and Sports Extra.
Hello, how's it going? It is Cathal Minogue. You are very welcome to another episode of The Kickoff, weekend number 6 in the Premier League. Off the Ball's Colin Buig will be in once again to chat about this weekend's fixtures. We'll also chat about the Ballon d'Or that was won this week, and we'll chat about, does anyone really care about it anymore? Also, I've got some Today FM alumni on the show. Ed Smith, formerly of this parish, he'll be in to chat about his undying love for Tottenham Hotspur. This is The Kickoff. Let's get into it.
The Kickoff
with Cathal Minogue and Sky Sports.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Kickoff. Once again, sitting in front of me is the wonderful, the man from Cork, Off the Ball's Colin Buig. You're looking great, Colin.
Thanks very much, Scott. You read that so naturally.
I know
you're just looking at your screen.
Straight from the heart.
Straight from the heart. Beautiful words received from a beautiful boy like yourself. You know what I mean?
Come here. Big week in the world of football. There was lots going on. I want to ask you about the Ballon d'Or. Dembele. PSG's Dembele won the Ballon d'Or, the men's Ballon d'Or. Is it relevant anymore?
Yeah, it is. I think it is to an extent. I mean, people can be cynical about it, and justifiably so in some places and from some quarters. But I think it's noteworthy that Ousmane Dembele, whatever about the subjectivity of that decision, is officially now, objectively, the world's best player according to Ballon d'Or. And it's funny, really, because like this time last year, like I'm not even talking about the season before last, I'm talking about last season, the season in which he won the Ballon d'Or from his work there. The first half of last campaign, he was nothing remarkable. And we were doing stats on the show, Cathal, on Off the Ball Breakfast with French journalists talking about how frustrated they are with this guy Dembele up front. So for people who can't quite remember or not sure of Dembele's history, he was at Barcelona until the recent past and went to PSG.
Yeah.
And the feeling was always bags of natural ability, but very raw, lacks composure, would be very wild at his finishing and erratic at times. And that was pretty much the case like 12 months ago. But he had the second half of second halves of last season, and his stats are through the roof. Like, so his goals and his assists and his impact in the Champions League. And look, PSG won the Champions League final handsomely. They destroyed Inter in the final. And Dembele was a huge part of their success from the second half of last season. So look, there's a formula when it comes to the Ballon d'Or. If you win the Champions League, or if you're part of a country that wins the European Championships or the World Cup, and you're a player who plays in the final third, and you're into double figures for goals and assists, there's a great chance you're going to win the Ballon d'Or.
Right.
The only controversy probably is that from some people, it should have been Lamine Yamal, the Barcelona youngster. So for the second year in a row, he won the young player version of the Ballon d'Or. And it's funny because Ruud Gullit was the co-host of the Ballon d'Or Awards during the week. And when he was presenting him with the young player version, he said, "Oh, I might see you up here later again." And he said that twice. And Lamine Yamal, you know, as young as he is, took it very maturely and was just kind of laughing awkwardly about it. And I don't know about that. But it was a mad thing to say from Ruud Gullit's point of view, because obviously, it wasn't Lamine Yamal who won it. It was Dembele. So he goes up, and I think people are delighted for him. And it was a PSG legend, or certainly cult figure at the very least, in Ronaldinho, who presented Dembele with the award. First ever Paris Saint-Germain player to win the Ballon d'Or. Can't help but feel delighted for the guy. Is he the best player in the world? Probably not, in all likelihood. He had a great season, though. He had a great campaign. Yeah. But at the same time, look, we're living in this post-Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi world, in that both Ronaldo and Messi are still playing football, of course, but they're out of contention for the Ballon d'Or. And there was a long old period where they were exchanging the Ballon d'Ors, basically, year by year. And so we're in that era now where, okay, so who is actually the best player in the world? And right now, as we sit here, Erling Haaland has the numbers again, and he goes through these spells, even by his own standards, Cathal, where he's phenomenal in terms of goals. Look at it for this season with club and country. He scored 5 goals in 1 game for Norway in the last international break. And if you've been watching Man City in the last couple of weeks alone, he's best player on the pitch. Mm. And it's not just his goal scoring, it's his build-up play. So you could argue, at the moment, Haaland he's difficult to get better than him at the moment. Lamine Yamal is injured. He didn't play against Newcastle in the Champions League at St James's Park. But again, he's still Barcelona's best player. He's still probably, arguably, the most talented player in the world at the moment. But you're left in a situation here where Dembele gets it. And it's a debatable one. But I like it. I like someone a bit different to get it especially after it was going between Ronaldo and Messi for so long.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, would Mo Salah feel hard done by in some shape or form?
Possibly.
I mean, would he be? He was the best player in the Premier League last
year. The only thing with Salah, right, is it's going back to that formula, which it's not an official formula, but it just feels that way, that Liverpool didn't win the Champions League. They, of course, won the Premier League, first time in front of a crowd, and Salah was unbelievable. Like, crucial to Liverpool's success, and has been since he joined the club. The only thing with Salah is he slightly tailored off at the end of last season, which is funny enough, when Dembele was really getting going the second half of last season, and he ended the campaign brilliantly. But probably they didn't win the Champions League, they didn't reach Champions League final, and as brilliant as they were in the Premier League, and they ran away with it, and that was not completely, but it had a lot to do with Salah. There was an argument to it at some point, for sure, but it's the Champions League that Dembele did it in for PSG.
Yeah.
And you can't argue with that. It's just, you know, is he truly the best player in the world? That is debatable. So anyway, he got the Ballon d'Or during the week in second place because they give a top three. So in second place was the aforementioned Lamine Yamal. Mm. And in third place was a PSG teammate of Dembele's, and it was Vitinha, the Portuguese midfielder. And so they had this incredible midfield three last season. They still have them there, but the reason that they got the treble last season under Luis Enrique, the French League and Cup as well, they had Vitinha, Fabian Ruiz and João Neves in midfield. Unbelievable. It's the closest thing we've probably seen in modern football to Barcelona's famous three of Busquets, Xavi and Iniesta. And funnily enough, none of those three won the Ballon d'Or either.
Xavi never won it.
Xavi and Iniesta were flirting with the idea. They came top three at one point, but they never won it.
So is there anyone interesting that would have been in the top three throughout the years that you would say?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So,
is there ever defenders in the top three?
Well, that's a really good question. So to give you a very quick answer, no. Because the last defender to win, Fabio Cannavaro, all the way back in 2006, the last defender to win Ballon d'Or.
Okay, did they win the World Cup
that year? They won the World Cup that year, exactly, because second place that year was a goalkeeper, which is, again, even more unlikely. That was Gianluigi Buffon.
Oh, what a guy. So, coolest guy ever.
Yeah, absolutely. And third that year was Thierry Henry. So Kaká won it the year after, the Brazilian playmaker,
yeah,
who excelled at AC Milan, got his move to Real Madrid, didn't really work out for him there. Funny enough, 2008 in third place, so it was the two boys, first and second, Ronaldo and Messi, in that order. And in third place in 2008, Fernando Torres.
Okay.
Hard to believe, isn't it? Because he became such a maligned figure when he transferred from Liverpool to Chelsea, and his career really petered out. Like, you know, the odd moment to Chelsea, but basically
that's peak. Liverpool.
That's peak Torres at Liverpool. Yeah, Xavi came third in 2009, and Iniesta and Xavi came second and third, respectively, the following year in 2010. Of course, that was the year that Spain won the World Cup, but Barcelona didn't win the Champions League that year. But Messi still got it in first place. So there's the odd exception where you don't follow the formula of winning the Champions League, the Euros or the World Cup. Or in Messi's case in 2021, Argentina won the Copa America for the first time in ages. But the exception is probably the generational talents like Messi and Ronaldo. They don't have to necessarily win those competitions. They're just freaks of nature when you're talking about, you know, say the greatest 11 to ever play the game. They're in the conversation. So if you look at other names in the top three, that's what I find most interesting. Like, third place in 2013 was Frank Ribery, the French winger.
Yeah.
Manuel Neuer, goalkeeper, got third in 2014. Germany won the World Cup, of course, that year, but it was still Ronaldo and Messi, top two. Antoine Griezmann in 2016 came third, even though France lost the Euros final that year to Portugal. Griezmann again 2018 when they didn't win the World Cup. Virgil van Dijk in 2019 when Liverpool won the Champions League came second. Robert Lewandowski in 2021, just pure goals. Sadio Mane 2022. You know, some of these names kind of pop up. Kevin De Bruyne as well.
Lewandowski is one that probably in a different era would have won a Ballon d'Or, you'd imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Because the problem is the two boys has dominated. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But even since 2000, you could go out and say of the 25 winners since, because there was no Ballon d'Or in 2020, the COVID year, first COVID year, that Dembele is probably the most surprising winner. Even though his numbers are not surprising that he won it. If you look at him objectively on paper, didn't see Dembele play, like, oh yeah, he probably is the best player in the world because of his numbers. Then you see him play Cahill and it's like, oh, like, unbelievable ability. I'm not saying he's a dud, but is he the best player in the world? I'm not sure.
1986, okay. Gary Lineker finished second.
Yeah, that's good, yeah. And it's fun.
Can you tell me who won it?
86.
86.
Must have been Maradona.
You're wrong. I'll give you one more guess. And you know what? I'll put my house on it that you aren't going to get this.
So you're saying to me it's not Maradona?
No.
Because Argentina win the 86 World Cup. And at that time, the mid-80s, Liverpool are the dominant side in England. But they might have, the European Cup might have dried up by then. Now, the Eastern Bloc had a lot of good players at that time. Am I getting somewhere?
Getting somewhere.
But I can't think of...
No, you'll never get it.
Who is it?
Soviet footballer Igor Belanov.
Oh, I've heard the name. Now, in my defence, I wasn't even a concept of the Lombard.
No, you weren't. But I was just going to test you, because if you had that, that would be incredible.
No, I'd leave the room if that was the case.
Igor Belanov won it. Gary Lineker still holds a small, teeny bit of a grudge, I think, that he doesn't have it. That was the year.
Isn't it funny with Lineker, like, is that he was such an accomplished footballer, and he's a broadcaster first, isn't he?
Yeah.
These days.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, most people would know him for as a broadcaster.
Like, what a life, like. Yeah. Underrated the way we talk about him as a footballer. People acknowledge he was a great striker, but Jesus, like, to come second in the Ballon d'Or and basically to be talked about now as a presenter and former footballer.
Yeah, he's very talented. Come here, other things in the world very quickly.
Yeah, loads happening.
Yes, the Cardiff beating Burnley in the Carabao.
Unbelievable.
And it's a great story.
Yeah.
Because we have a Cork man. You must be delighted.
Oh, I'm grinning, like, ear to ear. So Brian Barry Murphy's in charge of Cardiff City. Son, of course, of Jimmy Barry Murphy. Right? Now we're talking primary love language,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we had Brian Barry Murphy on the show on Off the Ball Breakfast this week, the morning after his Cardiff City side came back from all the way up there to Burnley and Turf Moor.
Right.
And they won that game 2-1. So that's League One, Cardiff, against the Premier League's Burnley. Now, you'd see, no, just promoted from the Championship, and Burnley made several changes to their side that would have been playing in the Premier League, but still, to do that, to go to Turf Moor and to win 2-1, and they actually got hammered at Turf Moor last season, if that's anything to go by at all, before Brian Barry Murphy got there, of course. So he was only appointed in the summer. This time last year, he was only getting ready to become Ruud van Nistelrooy's assistant at Leicester City, the doomed Leicester in the Premier League. And that, of course, went disastrously for Leicester. And then Brian Murphy finds himself being the head coach of Cardiff this summer. And what a guy, what an incredible brain like this guy has. I'm not talking about like an Irish guy, I'm certainly not talking about a Cork guy. This is just a really good young manager who's playing his trade in the UK. They're in the playoff positions already.
Yeah, they're fourth in the league.
Yeah. They've conceded the fewest goals as well. Callum Robinson.
Yeah, because he scored, didn't
he? Yeah, and he doesn't even get his game regularly. Like, he's in and out of the side. And that's the Republic of Ireland international, Callum Robinson. The guy is well big in the left back. He is an Ireland under 21 international. So there's a bit of interest for us beyond the head coach. But it's a remarkable story for Brian Barry Murphy, who, like, do you know, he has to follow in the footsteps in Ireland anyway of his father, which is next to impossible to do. But he's genuinely carving his own thing. And, like, bear in mind, he was coaching at Manchester City under the tutelage of Pep Guardiola. So he has these two totemic figures in his life, his own father and the most influential manager of the 21st century. And we're still talking about him first as the man. Do you know, it's not whose son he is or who he learned his trade under. No, Brian Barry Murphy, that's an interesting, they're interesting facts about him, but he himself is this really impressive individual.
He won the Sky Bet League One Manager of the Month award in August as well.
Exactly, yeah.
And they have a lovely, lovely fixture in the fourth round of the Carabao.
They do, Hollywood's Wrexham.
Yeah, so there's going to be eyes
Welsh
on that.
Derby.
Speaking of Hollywood, it's a big weekend, not just for the Premier League, but also in another sport that's, I think it's close to your heart. Are you a fan of golf?
I am a fan of golf, and I particularly love the Ryder Cup.
Yeah. Do you know, I have a fun fact for you. Gianfranco Zola.
Yeah.
He's going to be a bogey driver.
Amazing.
For Team Europe at this year's Ryder Cup. Will you be watching the Ryder Cup? Yeah.
Ah, totally, yeah. I love it. It's every 2 years, and then you kind of forget about it, and it's back with a bang. And look, the miracle of Medina was the last time Europe won away. That was back in 2012. The only other time this century, speaking of this century, we're talking about the Ballon d'Or, 2004 was the only other time. America haven't won away since, I think, the early 90s. So look, that's going to be the dominant feature of the sporting weekend right now. And we both understood that, so we're talking about beforehand. So it's like, okay, well, what are great battles in the Premier League history, right? So it's America versus Europe this weekend in the Ryder Cup. What are the best rivalries in the Premier League? And I went through them chronologically, and I won't go into chronological detail, but if you start from the Premier League era at the beginning, 92-93, United won the first, of course, won the first two. And so who were their big rivals then? Blackburn. Kenny Dalglish's Blackburn. So they win the Premier League title in 95, and they have Shearer and Sutton up front. That's the first real rivalry with Norwich City, who were very good at the first start of the Premier League era, and Coventry City and Aston Villa, they were a bit of a danger teams to them. Arsenal, not so much. Liverpool were in a period of transition. And Manchester City, of course, don't get going until 2008, and really not until 2012 is their first Premier League title. So it's a long, long way before Man City are involved. So United and Blackburn, the first America versus Europe. You can allocate who's who there in country versus continent.
Okay.
Second one, you got mid-90s, Manchester United again with Newcastle. Kevin Keegan, Carl, I would love it if we beat them.
You do that with footballers, like he said about Leeds, and when you do things like that about a man like Stuart Pearce, I've kept really quiet, but I'll tell you something. He went down in my estimation when he said that. We have not resorted to that, but I'll tell you, you can tell him now, if you're watching it, we're still fighting for this title, and he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Love it.
Which is probably the era of my favourite ever Premier League game, and a lot of people's. Anfield, 1996 in April, I think. Liverpool 4, Newcastle 3. There was 2-4-3 games in a row between Liverpool and Newcastle and Anfield in the 90s. This is the first one. I think this is the better one, where they exchange goal for goal. Faustino Asprilla scores one of the great goals of the Premier League, in my opinion, ever in that game, outside the right foot. So United versus Newcastle was great. Newcastle 12 points clear in the Premier League that season, and blew it around this point, actually, against Liverpool. So that for me is the second big America versus Europe. And then the third rivalry in the Premier League, which you could argue to this day, particularly people who lived through this era, was the big Ryder Cup, United against Arsenal.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Arsene Wenger's Arsenal.
Keane versus Vieira.
Right. Come on.
Exactly. So that's the individual battle for me. And look, that was perfect, like, childhood memory for me. I'm banging this area here, so I remember fondly that part of it. For people listening this morning, it could be more recent or further back. But what's undoubted is the genuine animosity between both teams, both captains that you just mentioned there, and certainly both managers in Alex Ferguson and Arsene Wenger. Some unbelievable battles. So Arsenal win the double in 98 and interrupt United's flow, and then again they win it in 2002 and they're invincible in 2004, and that's when United get left behind. Then Jose Mourinho comes in as Chelsea boss in the mid-2000s. This is Jose and Chelsea's world. Arsenal are hanging about, but they don't win the league title again, of course. And then you have Chelsea against Man United late 2000s. This is Avram Grant era Chelsea, but it's a very, very good Chelsea side. That's probably the last great Man United side under Alex Ferguson. This is when Tevez, Ronaldo, Rooney and Berbatov are up top. And then enter left of stage Manchester City, the noisy neighbours, as they were called by Alex Ferguson. This is the start of the 2010s. This is Europe versus America, but Man City have never gone away. United certainly have. Then it's Chelsea versus Man City in the mid-2010s, and now we're in the era just after Liverpool versus Man City. Re-enter Arsenal in the conversation. This is your Ryder Cup.
There you go. That doesn't whet the appetite. We must look ahead to some of the games this weekend. We will do that later on in the show. You'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
On the way, Ed Smith, who you might know from Today FM. He's a very, very proud Tottenham fan. It's on the way.
The Kickoff
with Cathal Minogue and Sky Sports.
Welcome back. Now, this is very exciting. I've decided to wander around the halls of Marconi House once again, the home of the Kickoff, looking for another proud football fan to chat with. This time, I found the wonderful Ed Smith.
In the basement, it wasn't the halls.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, in the basement. It's where we keep
chained
him
to the radiator.
You'll know his fabulous voice from years on Today FM. Yeah. Years. A voice as smooth as dairy milk. That's what I'd say.
Oh, yeah.
Your show, Ed Songs of Praise, was one of my favourite on the radio.
Thank you so much. I miss it probably every 5 minutes of my waking hours.
Yeah.
I loved it. The greatest time of my life.
Brilliant radio. I just used to love it. These days, you're producing on Go Loud.
Go Loud, yeah. I just moved up a floor. So I'm producing and kind of executive producing, editing, and getting involved with the podcast world. You may have heard of podcasts called the...
There wasn't a good football one. That's why I'm here.
So finally, we have a good football podcast. Yeah, so I'm involved in the world of podcasts. So still in the ether of Today FM, but in a kind of different, with a different hat on.
Yeah. Well, the reason you're here is because you're a Tottenham fan. That's why you're here. You're a Tottenham fan.
Yeah.
For your troubles?
For my troubles, for the most part. Let's be honest, I'm going to be very real in this conversation. It's not going to be too stat heavy, but a lot of emotion.
Okay, it's exactly
pretty
what
much
I want.
Sums up Tottenham's, for the time I've been following them anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of emotion. Most of it bad.
I enjoy your tweets.
Yeah.
You do a lot of live tweeting during games. And
I try to keep it in check because
Sometimes it gets out of hand.
Yeah. I feel it's, I have no one to talk to because I'm in my house. My 4-year-old does his best. But it's probably best he's not in the room when I'm watching Tottenham or Spurs. Or my partner in life, Michelle, has minus interest, if there's such a thing. I think she's aggressively uninterested.
Okay.
She proactively takes away interest from my football fandom. So the Twitter, as I would always call it, is an outlet for me to just vent for the most part. And as is increasingly the case, let's be fair, maybe heap praise on individual players or managers. But I try to keep it in check because I can talk absolute pony, as they say in the game. But it is a great way to go, rah! And then you get fellow travellers who are maybe Spurs fans, a lot of Liverpool fans getting on to me. We'll talk about it in another episode, maybe how they seem to be the ones that always come for me. But
really?
Oh yeah, Liverpool fans. Can we say it?
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Really?
Yeah. And I like the club. The fans.
That's interesting you say Smug. That. I noticed that because when I'm not hanging out on this show, I'm hanging out with Dave Moore on his radio show, 9 to 12, Monday to Friday.
Heard of it?
And on Monday mornings, and this has been the case now for the last number of years.
I know where you're going with this. You haven't even discussed this. You get a lot of texts from fans about United losing or something.
Yeah.
Mostly Liverpool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'm telling you. 90%.
I'm telling you. I'm catching strays from Liverpool fans, and I haven't even tweeted.
Okay.
Yeah, some guy came after me about when we won in Europe, and he goes, hardly deserved. And I was like, sorry, who are you? Like, he just came out of nowhere, and I said, let me just check his feed. Liverpool. Just, they're roaming the streets looking to rub people's noses in it. And I'm done with it. Anyway, but let's not talk about them.
Yeah,
they
let's
take
talk
up
about
enough of my headspace.
Yeah, that is interesting.
It's the pool fans, yeah.
Yeah. So talk to me about Tottenham. How long have you been supporting Spurs?
Do you know, I think I was at that seminal age when it really clicked for me, and there was one man responsible for that, was Paul Gascoigne. So I was 14 in around 1990. So obviously that was his tournament in Italy for the World Cup. The tears, the performances, the booking, he's going to miss the final, all that. And then the Walker's ads. But, you know, he was in and around, and I was always kind of, my father was a Spurs fan since they had that successful period in the 60s, they won the double and all that crack. So he was kind of, but my dad was a bit of a football nomad. He'd kind of followed, he'd followed the success. But
yeah,
it was then, I think, 1991, the FA Cup final, semi-final, sorry, in particular, against Arsenal in Wembley, when Gazza scored what I would consider one of the greatest free kicks of all time.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant! But even he can't believe it. Is there anything left from
the commentary from Brian Moore, the celebration, and I was watching that, enjoying it. But there's a very famous shot in Jaws where Roy Schneider is sitting on the beach. It's called the track and zoom, where Spielberg zooms in but tracks out at the same time. You often see it in movies when they've had this like, what the F moment.
Okay.
And I saw that, and the pores in my brain opened up. It was like listening to maybe REM or Nirvana for the first time. I was just at that age of 14 where everything is, you're taking everything and everything means so much. I saw the goal, and the molecules in my brain just kind of were never the same. Obviously, if I was a Spurs fan as a result. But I learned off his post-match interview. And my way to get me super measured. Wasn't bad, was it? Like I watched it over and over and over again. So Gazza then for me was my gateway drug, if you will, into Spurs, and from then on, you know, but, you know, you kind of drift in and out as life takes over. But I think then in my late teens, 20s, then it kind of solidified into kind of a weekly, bi-weekly drudge of, but, you know, with all the managers, we've had, I think it's 9 managers in 10 years going back to, you know, and it's been a roller coaster, it's fair to say. Mm. But with Tottenham, I have a slight issue with this kind of philosophy of football talk that goes around, you know, but I suppose traditionally one of the reasons that my father fell in love with them was because they had a certain kind of swagger and panache. Your Glenn Hoddles, your Ardiles, your...
Glenn Hoddle was cool.
Honestly, absolutely glory. If he was around today, you know, he had that gorgeous, lazy, effortless style.
Shorts.
Short. And do you know what? It takes a special player to wear socks around the ankles.
Yeah.
I think you have to, you have to reach a certain level of not just cool, but quality, like Baresi used to wear the socks around. Baggio, come on now. you have to deserve, you have to earn your right to wear your socks around your ankles.
Yeah.
And Hoddle earned that. He used to swagger around, shirt hanging out over the shorts. He was a big man as well, you know. A man who moved so delicately and put it on the eye of a needle.
Yeah.
Great. If I'd recommend anyone, any Spurs fans know this, the goal against Watford. Again, one of the great Spurs goals. You know, so it was these players that I think, you know, that Spurs have built up his reputation as being, you know, were very attacking and were kind of swashbuckling. But that's kind of worn a bit thin with me over the years. Because do you know what I loved as well? I love winning.
Yeah. Which hasn't been happening.
You know what? Actually, you can swashbuckle off. How's about putting a ball in the net and not conceding four in reply? So, you know, look, I think football fandom, as you know, you're much younger than I am, and as are maybe many of the audience, but football fandom has evolved from when I was. It was very linear back in the day, like early 90s. You might get Match of the Day, you'd read the back of the Sun, but that was it. You know, maybe the front of the tabloids was a lot of the places where you see, especially Paul Gascoigne. And then he went to Italy, of course, and, you know, and his career after that. But it was Paul Gascoigne, to go back to your question, that was my, I fell in love with how he played football. I fell in love with, I suppose, his persona, his personality, the drama he brought to the game. And he was an astonishing footballer. You know, not to focus too much on Gazza, but famously Ferguson wanted to sign him.
Yeah.
And if he'd gone to United under, he had Venables, obviously. And the reason he loved Terry Venables at Spurs, because Terry, old Tell, would put the arm around and indulge him. And even when he was England manager, he was the same. And there was some serious incidents with Gazza, like his behaviour was absolutely shocking, no doubt. But I think if he'd, with the talent he had, he needed a Ferguson to really, he would have gone on, if he hadn't got injured in the final, the FA Cup final 91, it's Gary Charles. He went in, he was too hyped up for it. If you watch the first booking, is after a couple of minutes, he is so up for it to the point where he just loses his mind. Two insane tackles and ruins his knee. Whether he was the same player again after that, we don't know. But I think if he'd gone to United under Ferguson, he would have, I think, gone out to even greater things. He achieved some amazing things, really. But one of those players, again, the romance of Gazza being what might have been. There's a slight touch of, oh.
Yeah.
And we love that in football, like George Best and even this new, like Alex, all these, what could have been? It adds a certain romance and a kind of a heartbreak to it that you feel very protective of him. But that was for me. And then over the years, good God, you know, in recent years, I think with being a Spurs fan, and I know I'll be getting this when this goes out from Liverpool fans. Come on, come at me. It's fine. There's nothing you can say to me that I haven't said to myself or shouted at the telly
okay.
over the years. But Spurs fans get bullied quite a lot. Because there's a certain notion. I think this is kind of
Spursy, isn't that what they say? Yeah,
I think it's Roy Keane is responsible. The attitude Roy Keane has towards Spurs is a watermark moment for, like, remember he told the stories like halftime there, like, I think to it, lads, it's Spurs, and they went out and scored three and they beat them in the end. It's like, what are you talking about? It's only Spurs. Why are you worried about? We're two down. It'll be grand. It's Spurs,
which is kind of interesting because he is a Spurs fan originally, wasn't he? When he was a young
fella? I mean, he probably was. Yeah, you know, I just that brought on a lot of, and that kind of clicked with people. Now it's Spursy, and like myself, if you're unfortunate to read my tweets, it's like, no, Dr. Tottenham's here. The joke is like, well, even when we're two up, I'm like, why are you comfortable? Why is this is worse than being 2-0 down? Because they're going to throw it away. And for so long, they did. 3-2. You know, so, but being a Spurs fan, I think, you know, it's a great preparation for life. It's a great metaphor for the slings and arrows that you have to deal with in work and in life and love, because it's tough. It has been tough, you know, if you can survive that. But I feel that they've been the boot boy for so long, because I think people think they have notions. They've, like, Spurs have, like, top six. Are you mad? Who do you think you are? Having these, like, we've an amazing stadium. We hear all about this.
Yeah.
Training facilities. And they're one of the most financially successful.
Well, that's clubs. It, because when you're not about notions, it was the ninth highest earning football club in the world last year. Annual revenue of £615 million.
Yeah.
Like, and
a very well run club. And Levy.
Gone. But are you happy with that?
Again, I felt when it happened, I was quite shocked.
You know, out of nowhere.
And I feel there's be a thing. My friend, a good friend of mine, Eddie, who's a Liverpool fan, despite being my friend, but I would always say to him, there's a protest at the Spurs stadium or outside the stadium. We're going to win. Every time there was a massive protest, Spurs put in an amazing performance. I was like, I wish they protest every week. You know, I understand the frustration of the fans that with Joe Lewis, the owner, who very much keeps in the back, and Enoch, and Levy was very much the poster boy, but some of the stories about his negotiation tactics are frightening. He was a monster.
The slamming on the table.
Well, just like, they think the deal is done. and then some guy in maybe Milan or Middlesbrough, wherever it is, gets a call at 4 a.m. going, actually, Daniel's on the phone. He goes, what now? Oh my God, please. He just would grind and grind and grind to squeeze every last advantage. So look, a very tough negotiator. Spent like the Gareth Bale money that they spent.
Mm.
I think Levy did a lot for the club, and I think there's a certain lack of gratitude towards what he did get right. Obviously the stadium, the financial situation he's left us in is very stable. Second most valuable club at work, recently just valued $3 billion. That's Levy. You know, and he's brought us that. He did bring Thomas Frank in. He brought Poch in. You know, we've had some great days. And, you know, we've got some great players, some great signings, like recently this season, very impressed with Kudus in particular. But I do feel there's a certain entitlement that Spurs fans have as well, that they kind of expect too much too quickly. And the outrage, but this is across football fandom in general, like the lack of patience. Like, for example...
patience, though. I mean, how patient can you be in Daniel Levy's time? It's two cups.
I know. Look, the return was dreadful. But we did have a chance. You know what I mean?
Champions League final.
That wasn't a handball against Sissoko. Again, Liverpool fans, I'm goading you. But they were lucky to get there. Let's be honest about it. We had some glory times. We came second that year. If things we were close. But he should have won more, no doubt about it. But at the same time, I think that we should be very grateful that he was there at the time. He's left the club for whatever reason. An incredibly sound financial structure, which is half most of the game now. You have to be financially sound. And he's left it with an amazing stadium. And, you know, so I'm very grateful. I never really bought into the hate for Levy. But we'll see what happens now. They're going to invest 100 million. We'll see how they spend that. We don't know. But there's something, I think there's something good going on with Thomas Frank. To go back to this, being a Spurs fan, we're the butt of many, many jokes, which I understand. But look, we do have ambition. We do try to play in a certain way. We do have certain expectations. When I say we, the fans do. And I think if things fall right for us, which I think they could do, with Thomas the Frank engine, we could get, dare to dream to get top four again.
Yeah, but that's interesting though, because as you were saying about Tottenham kind of being the butt of the joke,
yeah, they are.
Manchester United are like that as well currently. Winning the Europa League last year,
yeah.
It felt, I don't know, how did it feel as a fan? Because it was a strange win. You're even admitting yourself, it was a terrible game.
Horrible, terrible
final. The only reason you really wanted to get in it is just so you could get Champions League.
Just also really interesting. And I was in the pub, I can't remember the name of it, God forgive me. It's near the South Circular Road, great pub. Patter something. Anyway.
Patter Browns,
yeah. Great spot.
Mm.
Me and my Man United friend, Oisin. And there was one or two Spurs fans, mostly United, as you can imagine. There was one Spurs fan across the way from me. And when the final whistle went, we just looked at each other and we walked across the floor, two strangers, and we just embraced. So it was just a sense of like, it's over.
Yeah,
like
okay.
The monkey is off our back. They've ripped it. It's gone. They can't. That's a stick now. That's one less stick.
But there's still half a stick there to say,
oh, they'll find
you
something.
Bet a terrible Manchester United team.
Yeah. Oh, the worst fight.
It was awful. It was an awful fight.
Yeah, I know.
All of that stuff. You're 17th in the league.
They'll always find something.
It's an interesting,
you know what I mean? And look, that's what I get so much joy out of. You know, I suppose that the identity I have with Spurs, the frustration I feel with them, you know, the fact that they think they're bigger than they are, and people who have no not stick in the game, but like Arsenal fans, you can understand to a certain degree, Chelsea, West Ham, you know, London teams, but Sunderland fans are Newcastle, just take an absolute glee in the downfall of Spurs. And I'm like, what's it got to do? Just leave us alone. What's it got to do? You've got your own issues. So I love all that and identify with that a lot. So I love them till I die. They'll probably kill me. So that's a nice relationship and a nice deal to have. But, you know, but things are going well at the moment. Where they'll finish, realistically, top six I'm taking.
Okay. Well, that's an incredible
turnaround
from last year.
But who knows, top four, you never know.
Yeah. Well, I feel like you will love them till you die. And we might have to wrap you up after this. Close up some of those wounds we're opening
up. I'm aware to get me suit measured.
Do you go over to many games?
Yeah. Do you know where I was? I was actually at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, this is one of the great ones now, when Son scored that goal against Burnley. I don't know if you remember, was it a Puskas winner, but he started just beyond the halfway line and he beat about 9 players. And I saw that with my own eyes. And then he knocked it in and the stadium itself, if you've not
So this was in the new stadium?
In the new stadium. Astonishing.
Column, who is obviously Colin Bouygues from this very said podcast, he was over there for a match last year. And he said the stadium alone is just something
it's beautiful.
Worth seeing. Yeah. The world's first ever retractable pitch.
Yeah.
I think they worked with U2's sound engineers.
Oh, it's all there. Like oftentimes,
the acoustics of the
crowd. You wish they'd retract the pitch while they're on it. just hit the button.
What are those days like?
Oh, they're great. You know what I mean? Like it's any fandom. You know, it was Burnley. I suppose it wasn't a derby, or it wasn't Rangers Celtic, but still getting in, just the wonder of it. It is a beautiful stadium. I was kind of a bit fearful that it was going to be like the Emirates, or God forgive me for saying that, but the atmosphere wasn't going to be. It was lit, and the sound, as you say, the acoustics, getting into your seat, the staff, and it's beautiful to look out from the outside. It's so easy to get in and out, get out Seven Sisters, walk up. Great atmosphere, lovely, warm family vibe. It was great.
So and does it not lose some of the good thing about English football? Some,
the White Hart Lane-ness of it,
Yeah. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I think
same now when you look at Hill Dickinson Stadium, which looks incredible, looks really steep.
But Goodison, yeah.
But there was something about Goodison. And you hear ex-players, you often hear like Roy Keane and Gary Neville them talking about how they used to hate the tunnel in Goodison.
Yeah.
And how you're walking out and they're on top of you. All of that is a small bit lost with these incredible stadiums.
No, there is. And I think West Ham has suffered that more than most with the Olympic...
London Stadium. Yeah.
But they've suffered more than most because they've got that track around and the distance between... Anyway, look.
And look what's happening there.
Yeah, I know. But look, Craven Cottage is the one for me now. That is the epitome of what a proper... It isn't big enough. They're losing probably millions a year because of it, and I hope they never get rid of it. White Hart Lane had to go. Whether they could have built it there, I don't know. Obviously, it couldn't have been done logistically. But that's what I suppose when I was fearful going in, because I've been to White Hart Lane so many times that I thought, oh no, it's not going to be. And, it wasn't White Hart Lane, but it was new. But the atmosphere was so strong. It was so loud. You could, they've done an amazing job of it. And the way that's, I suppose, the Poznan stand at the back, it really does feel like a bit of a bowl. It can be like a cauldron.
Yeah.
And the facilities are second to none. So we'll make it our own, same as Everton will. A couple of good wins, a couple of good memories, and we'll be talking about it as if it's the new White Hart Lane.
Can I ask you about football chants? Mm. So when you're heading over to these games, now, what's the story with the football chants? And do you learn them first of all? Yeah. And also, do you embrace this British accent as well when you're chanting them? Because if you ever hear any other fan, they could be from Cork, Dublin, Mayo, Limerick, wherever. And then they just embrace this what do we think of Tottenham? You're not singing that one. But
I always love this. When I'm watching a game at Anfield, not Anfield, even on telly, you can hear the Scouse accent coming out of, say, 50,000 people. You're going, ew! And you would hear it all in one. It's amazing to hear it. You can hear the accent. That's a great question. Yeah, you have to, don't you? Because I think with a London accent, which I'm blessed I can do fairly easily. I suppose you don't want to be going who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Say it like your mother. Yeah. Who are you now? West Ham. Who are you? Who do you think you are? You've got to go. Who are you?
Are you giving it that?
You have to give it. Honest to God.
Is there a good chant?
I can't think of it. Nothing I can repeat now.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't want to get you fired. The series is going well.
Yeah, there's never any clean chants, is there?
No, there shouldn't be. There really shouldn't. It's we appreciate you coming today. Ooh-ah, ooh-ah. No, it's none of that. Some of it is gas. Some of it's not. So, some of it is, you just don't want to get involved. Some of the stuff I've heard. I'll tell you what off air, which you'll... knock the hairs off your chest.
Okay.
And I cannot do it now because it is so shocking.
Really, yeah.
But it's all part of the banter, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. You love it. You love the game.
I love the game, and I miss it. At the end of last season, I was so glad it was over. I was emotionally, Ange broke me. That football, the results. And then winning at the end, it was almost just as tiring. I need a break from them. I need a break from them. I almost relish international breaks sometimes if things are going badly, but we always lose before an international break, and there's one coming up soon. So
put
your money down, but don't hold me to that. But I do love it. I love the crack. I love the stats side of things. I'm not that strong on it. People are very strong on.
There's two sides to it, isn't it, though? Because you can be very strong on the stats and the tactics, and that's the name of the game. But also, you can be just a fan through emotion.
Yeah.
And the colour of it all.
Well, it is, and it should be, you know what I mean? You might like a player and then someone goes, yeah, but like his XG is 0.3 worse than, you know, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just like the way he carries himself.
Yeah.
And I hope that doesn't get lost in people being bet down with, you know, but you haven't, it's been 14 minutes since there's been a corner, you know, and you go, or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, lowest rate of corners in the first 12 minutes of, you go, are they any good?
Yeah.
How are they playing? Are they doing okay? Yeah, grand. Let's get on with it. So it's easy to get back down with that. But I assume the proliferation of football chat in the media, it's always going to go that way. But I love them.
Not on this podcast.
Not on this podcast. Good.
I
just say, I have been listening. And that's why I'm loving it so much. Because it's at exactly where I would appreciate and love football. It's coming from the heart. And this show is doing so well because it's not, you're not rage baiting people by saying, you know, I think they're right. Lionel Messi, come on.
Terrible.
Come on, leave your comments. I'll leave my comment.
Yeah, thank
on your
you.
Arse. But like, I just think that's what's going great with it. And I want to applaud you for that. It's a proper football show, you know, for fans that aren't as rabid or as stat heavy or as, you know, competitive with each other or dreaded banter. So well done. And thank you for giving me a platform,
Ed,
to rile up the Liverpool fans once again. Come at me.
Thank you. Thank you. You've been a fantastic guest.
Oh.
Definitely, you know what I'm going to say? You've been the most emotional.
Yeah.
Emotionally available.
Oh. Damaged. Damaged, would you say?
Look, we've seen a couple of things that I've seen
you
in a different light.
I'm sorry for taking my pants off, but thankfully there's no camera.
You are playing Wolves this weekend, by the way, which is, you know, it's a lovely fixture. Isn't these it? Saturday night, 8 p.m.
Yeah.
Kickoffs. They are sweet.
I also love watching Wolves because they're terrible at the moment.
Haven't won a game.
No. I love their kits. They're always great to look at. I love their kits. And if Spurs, look, they should be Wolves because Wolves are on a really terrible run. But the manager just signed a contract, which is mad. But they're going to find their form. And invariably, the pessimist in me, which is 80% of me as a Spurs fan, it'll be against Spurs.
We'll wait and see. It's live on Sky Sports, 8 p.m. Saturday night. Ed Smith, thank you so much. Best of luck for the year. Look, what are we saying? Top six?
Top six. I'll take top six, yeah.
Top six. Okay. If you're going back down like you were last year, you might come back on again?
I might. Catch me at about 9 a.m. when I'm just coming in from the early hours.
Yeah. Thanks a million, man.
The Kickoff with Cathal Minogue.
Now, we'll look ahead to some of this weekend's games, particularly Sunday. Colin Bouygues from Off the Ball is still with me.
Yeah. Hello. How are you?
One of the biggest games of Sunday is probably Newcastle-Arsenal, is it?
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, St James's Park. 4:30 p.m. on Sunday, just as the Ryder Cup's really getting the teeth of it. We hope. Arsenal under Mikel Arteta, they have nearly everything in the bag to win the Premier League, but will they under this manager? That's the big question when it comes to them. They have all the tools. They have a great squad. The rotation we saw on offer during the week in the League Cup, but it's just a question of, does the manager truly believe that Arsenal can win the Premier League? You go to places like St James's Park. We saw Liverpool do it the start of this season. Rio Ngoma, the 16-year-old Liverpool's youngest scorer in the Premier League. They did it and they didn't play too well. They won 3-2. I'm not sure if Arsenal are that level yet of self-belief that Liverpool have, but that is undoubtedly on paper the game of the Premier League weekend. It's St James's Park, Newcastle United against Arsenal, 4:30 on Sunday.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if Newcastle can get more goals. Also, we have West Ham, Everton. Mm. West Ham are in a bit of a dire straits at the moment.
They are. Graham Potter, at the time of speaking, Cahill, is still in charge.
As we speak, yes.
Of the Hammers, but Slaven Bilic is waiting in the wings, and possibly Nuno
Espirito
Santo, who recently left Nottingham Forest, of course. So that's the Monday night game at the Hill Dickinson Stadium. That's Everton's new place, 8 o'clock. Everton against West Ham. Everton have been really solid under David Moyes, and they have a bit of flair as well in the shape of Jack Grealish and Kieran Dewsbury. Hall midfield is doing quite well for them, but this could very well be Graham Potter's last game in charge of West Ham. If they get beaten comfortably, which they could very well do against Moyes' side, I think it could be the end.
Give us your two predictions.
So I'm going to have Newcastle 0, Arsenal 3, right? I'm going to have a coming of age performance from Mikel Arteta's side. St James's Park has caused Arsenal problems in the last couple of years. We've seen Mikel Arteta have a breakdown there basically after one of the games, complaining about the refereeing decisions. So I'm going to go though for Newcastle not having the cutting edge required to beat this mean defence of Arsenal, and Arsenal finally showing up.
Okay, you were right, by the way. One game you were right last weekend. Mm. The Merseyside Derby, Liverpool-Everton. You got that right, 2-1. The rest, you were just totally wrong. So let's see. Yeah, as in you were wrong. So that means totally wrong. Colm, thanks a million. We'll talk to you again next week. That's all I'm saying. Good luck.
The Kickoff with Colm Minogue and Sky Sports.
It's not too often you get to tell Colm Boohig that he's wrong. So when you do, well, you have to kind of milk it, don't you? We kind of ran out of time there. We didn't really get to discuss too many games that are on this weekend. Some of the other ones to mention, you have Brentford, Man United. That's Saturday, 12:30. Interesting one for Brentford. Keith Andrews, Brentford, of course. United away from home. You also have Chelsea, Brighton, City play Burnley, Crystal Palace and Liverpool. That's going to be a great game. And then on Sunday, Villa, Fulham. It's an interesting one for Villa fans at this very moment. Badly need 3 points there. As we mentioned earlier on, Newcastle, Arsenal and Everton take on West Ham on Monday night. My favourite fixture that has been ongoing this season is the 8 p.m. kickoffs on a Saturday night. I mentioned this with Ed Smith earlier on. Tottenham Wolves is on this Saturday live on Sky Sports. I just love those ones. If you're able to grab onto the telly, I know there's lots of things on at the moment. You might be battling with Strictly or something like that. But if you're able to stick on Sky Sports, Tottenham Wolves is on Saturday night. A nice little treat as maybe you light the fire. It's starting to get a bit cold out there. Things are motoring. They're moving on pretty swiftly. Before you know it, we'll be into Christmas when it's just full of football. And we won't be complaining either. Thanks very much for listening. kickoff@todayfm.com. is the email address. If you like what you hear, it would really help the show if you can click follow or like or subscribe or whatever it is that it's asking you to do on your podcast feed, or if even if you could leave a little review once it's a good one. If it's a bad one, just tell one friend and tell them to keep it to themselves. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back again next week. Enjoy the football. Good luck.
The Kickoff with Cathal Minogue and Sky Sports.
Watch every Premier League match this season with Sky Sports and Sports Extra.